Chapter 6 There was an antique wicker chair with a torn cushion and a frayed quilt over the back. No one had ever used it but the cat. Ray backed into it because it was the nearest place to sit, and for a long time he sat there, across from the sofa, waiting for his father to start breathing, to wake up, sit up, take charge of matters and say, "Where's Forrest?" But the judge was motionless. The only breathing at Maple Run was Ray's rather labored efforts to get control of himself. The house was silent, the still air even heavier. He stared at the pallid hands resting peacefully and waited for them to rise just slightly, up and down, very slowly as the blood began pumping again and the lungs filled and emptied. But nothing happened. His father was straight as a board, with hands and feet together, chin on chest, as if he knew when he lay down that this last nap would be eternal. His lips were together with a hint of a smile. The powerful drug had stopped the pain. As the shock began to fade, the questions took over. How long had he been dead? Did the cancer get him, or did the old man just crank up the morphine? What was the difference? Was this staged for his sons? Where the hell was Forrest? Not that he would be of any help. Alone with his father for the last time, Ray fought back tears and fought back all the usual tormenting questions of why didn't I come earlier and more often and why didn't I write and call, and the list could go on if he allowed it. Instead, he finally moved. He knelt quietly beside the sofa, put his head on the judge's chest, whispered, "I love you, Dad," then said a short prayer. When he stood, he had tears in his eyes, and that was not what he wanted. Younger brother would arrive in a moment, and Ray was determined to handle the situation with no emotion. On the mahogany desk, he found the ashtray with two pipes. One was empty. The bowl of the other was full of tobacco that had recently been smoked. It was slightly warm. At least Ray thought so, though he was not certain. He could see the judge having a smoke, while he tidied up the papers on his desk, didn't want the boys to see too much of a mess. Then when the pain hit, he stretched out on the sofa, a touch of morphine for a little relief. Then he drifted away. Next to the Underwood was one of the judge's official envelopes, and across the front he had typed, "Last Will and Testament of Reuben V. Attlee." Under it was yesterday's date, May 6th, 2000. Ray took it and left the room. He found another diet soda in the refrigerator and walked to the front porch, where he sat on the swing and waited for Forrest. Should he call the funeral home and have his father moved before Forrest arrived? He debated this with a fury for a while. Then he read the will. It was a simple one-page document with no surprises. He decided he would wait until precisely 6 p.m., and if Forrest hadn't arrived, he would call the funeral home. The judge was still dead when Ray returned to his study, and that was not a complete surprise. He replaced the envelope next to the typewriter, shuffled through some more papers, and at first felt odd doing so. But he would be executor of his father's estate and would soon be in charge of all the paperwork. He would inventory the assets, pay the bills, help lead the last remnants of the Attlee family money through probate, and finally put it to rest. The will split everything between the two sons, so the estate would be clean and relatively simple. As he watched the time and waited for his brother, Ray poked around the study, each step watched carefully by General Forrest. Ray was quiet, still not wanting to disturb his father. The drawers to the roll top were filled with stationery. There was a pile of current mail on the mahogany desk. Behind the sofa was a wall of bookshelves, crammed with law treatises that appeared to have been neglected for decades. The shelves were made of walnut and had been built as a gift by a murderer freed from prison by the judge's grandfather late in the last century, according to family lore, which as a rule went unquestioned until Forrest came along. The shelves rested on a long walnut cabinet that was no more than 3 feet high. The cabinet had six small doors and was used for storage. Ray had never looked inside. The sofa was in front of the cabinet, almost entirely blocking it from view. One of the cabinet doors was open. Inside, Ray could see an orderly stack of dark green Blake and Son stationer's boxes, the same ones he'd seen as long as he could remember. Blake and Son was an ancient printing company in Memphis. Virtually every lawyer and judge in the state bought letterheads and envelopes from Blake and Son, and had been doing so forever. He crouched low and moved behind the sofa for a better look. The storage spaces were tight and dark. A box of envelopes without a top had been left sitting in the open door, just a few inches above the floor. There were no envelopes, however. The box was filled with cash. $100 bills. Hundreds of them packed neatly in a box that was 12 inches across, 18 inches long, and maybe 5 inches deep. He lifted the box, and it was heavy. There were dozens more tucked away in the depths of the cabinet. Ray pulled another one from the collection. It, too, was filled with $100 bills. Same for the third. In the fourth box, the bills were wrapped with yellow paper bands with $2,000 printed on them. He quickly counted 53 bands. $106,000. Crawling on all fours along the back of the sofa and careful not to touch it and disturb anybody, Ray opened the other five doors of the cabinet. There were at least 20 dark green Blake and Son boxes. He stood and walked to the door of the study, then through the foyer onto the front porch for fresh air. He was dizzy, and when he sat on the top step, a large drop of sweat rolled down the bridge of his nose and fell onto his pants.